And I would like to welcome you to tonight's program. This is Bruce Birch, and I am presenting for your perusal All Things Reconsidered. You are listening to All Things Reconsidered. My name is Bruce Birch, and I'm your host for the evening. And just wanted to let you know that I'm glad that you're here along with us tonight. We do have some interviews tonight. One in particular is Peter Werby, who is going to be with us tonight. What an amazing guy Peter is, and I'm really looking forward to hearing that with you. I also have on tap tonight Steady from Ojai, California. Steady is a recurring guest at All Things Reconsidered. So sit back and relax. Give us a listen. We are online at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. We're also on archived on whiterosesociety.org, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that later on in the show. But if you are listening, you have found All Things Reconsidered by Bruce Birch, and sit back and relax. We got a great show for you. The first interview that we're going to be bringing to you tonight, by the way, welcome. I always forget to do that, but welcome to the show. Really glad that you're here to join us tonight in this late October evening of October the 23rd. This is our 12th show, and tonight we've got a real treat for you. We've got Peter Werby, who will be on the show a little bit later. But first, I wanted to play an interview that I did with a very, very good friend of mine named Steady. He's a friend of the show and has been with us a number of times. He will be coming up here in just a moment. Anyway, it's been a wonderful week. We have all been, you know, sitting around and tapping our feet, waiting for Patrick Fitzgerald to drop the I-bomb, the indictment bomb. And who knows if it'll be this week. I've heard Randy Rhodes say probably 5 days in a row that it's going to be tomorrow. It's going to be tomorrow. You know, and I know for sure that it'll happen when it happens, and I certainly hope that when it does happen, that what he brings forward is something that will actually stick. So maybe that's why he's waiting as long as he has. But we will go directly over to the interview now with Steady from Ojai, California. Steady's been on the show a number of times, and he has some things he wanted to share with us. So let's go ahead over to that, and we'll get over to the interview with Peter Werby later on in the show. All right, I'm on the phone with Steady from Ojai, California, and Steady is with us once again. Man, it's great to have you back on with us, Steady. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. We had a pretty busy week this week. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. As Tom says, but I'll get better.
That's good. Looking forward to tomorrow.
All right. We had talked a little bit before we started the interview, and you were saying some things about the poetry.com bio that you had written and wanted to share with us.
Oh, yeah. I think I'll give a little background on the poetry.com. I'm sure many are familiar with that, but I'm kind of a creative guy, and I do write some poetry. Some of the listeners at Tom Harmon might be familiar with my little rhymes, but so I sent off my stuff to this poetry.com, and they sent me back a letter, said, "Hey, your stuff's great, and we're going to publish you." And I was, like, thrilled. So I sent them a copy and a release, and then they wanted a proof. And when I went through the proof and they sent it back to me, it was altered, and my bio was altered. And I just took that as, like, you guys don't really want to facilitate the creative stuff. You just want to produce these books. And I come to find out it's like a $15 million business a year. capitalizing on people's desire to be published, get their published works out there. So that's just a little heads up, but I want to share, some of the bio with you because I'm making friends out there. I just feel it.
Okay.
And people in Tom Harmon,
sure,
at the chat room, and I actually sat with Joyce Riley in the midst of meeting all of you in Tom Hartman's chat room. She came to Ventura, and this is just a small spin-off of what I've been able to accomplish through, you know, cumulative efforts and group, the meeting in the chat room. These are the things. So I want to share a little bit more about myself, intimate stuff, where I grew up and who I am.
Okay.
So maybe someone might like me or like who, you know, find out more about someone they don't like.
Well, you know,
I want to share.
We really do.
I like sharing. So I'm going to go ahead and read it because I don't have it figured out really.
Okay.
And I wrote it for poetry.com. And it says, I'm an only son adopted by a Swiss man and a German woman who had two daughters at the time. My younger sister, who was 8 months, when I was 8 months, came into the picture, and we looked like twins, blonde and blue, and the best kids in the world. Aren't yours, too? But I live in Ojai, and when I moved up here from Ventura County, from Huntington Beach, where I grew up and went through kindergarten through 12th grade, I got stationed at Point Magoo when I was in the Navy, and I found the area up here, the Gold Coast. It's just beautiful, rocky coast to the south and north, and we still have some agriculture here and mountain ranges that surround the whole area. I love my country, and I stand firmly in the American intellectual tradition that was represented in our founding fathers at the conception of what the United States was to become. And a gentleman who I mentioned earlier in our Katrina issue, who's been running for president, and he's been blackmailed out of it, but he's the greatest leader in my life, and that's Lyndon LaRouche. He's presented the best of human history for anyone to consider in his numerous publications. He's revived Schiller, and with his premier publication, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented over the last 30 years the socioeconomic changes that have plunged the world into our current system. Situation. But I'm a total optimist, and I'm going to close out the bio with a little saying that I say to everyone, that the only way for real or founded optimism is to know how bad it is. If you don't know how really bad it is, you might make moves that won't really address the true cause of the problem, and therefore be unsuccessful in eliminating those problems. So that's my little bio, but I want to send a few shouts out, not to you, Bruce, and Tom Hartman, again, for providing the means by which we met. To my friends all over Orange County, Ventura, Evan Austin for the Ojai Peace Coalition, Miss Julia, who works at KPFK, Joyce Riley, and the people at the Power Hour, David Von Kleist. All these people have empowered me through their own works to go deeper and deeper and become more impassioned or passionate about what it is I'm doing. And you too. You provide the outlet, Bruce. You give me a means by which, you know, I'm talking on the phone with someone who I've never met and to people who I may never meet. But I know the interest, if we are similar of like mind, if you will, that the desire's there. We see things in our country that are wrong. We have a certain sense of responsibility, and many of us want to actually accept that and do something. And I think what you and I are doing at this minute on the phone is the beginning of the change. Now, pardon me, sorry, I'm working on that.
I can edit
about the smoking.
Yeah, I can take that out.
Right, but into the things that need to be changed. I think this Tom DeLay thing that went down this week and his mug shot and the arrest and Tom DeLay being out on bail is a precursor. It's a precursor to the rest of the indictments that are going to follow this week and into November, excuse me.
Steady.
You know, pick a name.
Steady, tell me something.
Sure.
In your estimation, or in some of the channels that you travel and in some of the things that you listen to and are involved in, what, you know, who has been the primary name of subject when with regard to the indictments from Patrick Fitzgerald?
Coming up, you know, right now?
Yes.
Louis Libby, that hasn't been named. I mean, they're talking about it.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I understood your question.
Well, you know, what I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, I know you listen to a lot of alternative press and a lot of alternative media, or should I say independent, not dependent media.
Okay, that's fair.
But you know, that's often where the you know, real news is. But
yes.
You know, I guess what I'm trying to find out is, you know, based on everything that you've heard, you know, what has been the sort of resonating truth that has sort of come risen above? I mean, you know, I've heard, well, based on some of the things that I've heard, that actually Libby is, or that there are a couple of aides to Cheney that are rolling on Cheney, that he may end up actually being a subject of the indictments. Have you heard that?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
And that comes right, that goes right back to the counsel from Richard Nixon, who, and I forgot his name. I had some stuff there. I don't want to go fumbling through my stuff. But let's just say, if anyone looks it up, the counsel for Richard Nixon told Nixon and his staffers, said, look, if they come after you, you don't go down for these guys. You don't fall on the sword. You point them out. And that's exactly what's happening to Libby. Libby's going to point out Cheney. Cheney's going down.
So you think? Who do you think?
Again, if you look at the mastermind of the entire, you know, Bush presidency, and as far as the military operations being launched because of September 11th, and that being the perfect smokescreen for the financial system going down, it's a perfect plan. He'll be asked to leave the office and won't even be charged. He got the whole thing rolling and done. And look at Paul Wolfowitz.
Yeah.
He's now head of the World Bank.
Yeah.
That guy hated Saddam Hussein and was the hardest, hardcore neocon out in the open conspiracy about starting a war, a preemptive war in Iraq. And he did a good job. He got it done. And nice job, Wolfie. Now you're president of the World Bank. You know, let that genie be shown. Do our dirty work, and we'll make you, you know, we'll make you what you want
to
be.
And, you know, and it seems almost like that, you know, this president, you have to really screw up royally in order to get promoted. But, I mean, the worse you are, the better off you're, you know, chances are of you becoming, you know, something really lofty. But, so you're saying, so, and you also, you're concurring with a lot of the rumors that are floating about that Cheney may actually be indicted. What do you, so you don't think President Bush is going to be named as anything related to this, or is he sort of going to magically escape comment?
I don't think he'll magically escape comment, but I think the general consensus is amongst you know, the wise men in Washington, if there are any, is that Bush himself is not capable of orchestrating any of this stuff, and he's just basically, when you remove the bodies around him, he'll be like a single charcoal briquette burning by himself and not lasting very long.
Yeah.
The fire that's burning, you know, that's been getting all this stuff going, that needs the cumulative effort of the bodies around him and the personnel in different departments and at the high places. And as they break that down, like they did with the Speaker of the House, you know, they're not going to be able to contain these things in Congress. And the Senate's already established a bipartisan coalition of 14 by which we will continue these investigations and get to something of a truth and get the nation back on track. And I think I got lost in that, but Bush is going to be, he'll be just kind of carted off on the side. Come along now, pat on the head. We'll get you your little back 40 and a place where you can hang out, and you don't have to worry about any of this stuff more, George. You did your job.
And,
you know,
and his job was not to so much uphold conservative ideals as it was to push neoconservative perspectives and also the corporatist slash fascist philosophy as well.
I'd agree with that. I would say that not only was he used by those corporate fascists, but he was used in an unwittingly way. Or let's say the conservative consensus, you know, the Christians and the, you know, the conservative people around the Republican circles and those who have the same type of thinking were used as an administrable voting block, knowing that if they could get these numbers And how would you do that using a born again guy like Bush? They could be a wolf. Bush would be the wolf in sheep's clothing. Well, he would sue the Pied Piper. Well, that's not appropriate, but he would be the guy who, you know, he's the false prophet, if you will.
Sure.
I'm a born again, and I love God, and he told me to do this, but at the same time, he's killing people in a way that, you know, preemptively. I just, there's something there that I haven't worked out.
I'll tell you what it's called. It's called
being there. The guys, it's a paradox.
It's called being a sociopath.
Okay.
I mean, it's about.
Cheney is definitely a sociopath. Well, I don't know if Bush.
I think Bush is telling me that this, the fact, you know, as Mike Malloy calls him, the giggling murderer. I mean, you know, every time death is mentioned in a very serious tone, he tends to start chuckling. And I know that's not indicative of anything besides the fact that he likes to chuckle when death is mentioned. But you know, sociopathy is marked by, criminal behavior, actions that harm other people without any sort of a feeling of remorse at all whatsoever. We've not seen this man express remorse once, not once. And every single one of the, like, for instance, the Gold Star mothers and servicemen, their parents who have died, the servicemen who have died in service to the country have all expressed pretty much the same thing, which is that he was highly disrespectful of, you know, their grieving. And, you know, that all points to one thing, is that the man has no remorse for what he's done, for the pain and the suffering he's caused other people.
Bruce, let me ask you, Gold Star mothers, are those mothers of flag officers?
Gold Star mothers are mother that basically, the Gold Star families are families of servicemen who have died in service of the country. Now they don't have to be officers. Casey Sheehan, whose mother is Cindy Sheehan, I think it was a Lance Corporal. I mean, he wasn't like an officer. So,
okay. Now on the Cindy Sheehan, and I heard someone say, I'm not sure who it was now, that she faced the death of her son, and that, you know, they were commenting on her courageousness, and she says it's not even courageous anymore. It's absolutely no fear. I've lost my son. My son has been killed. I'd rather die before my son gets killed. I don't have any fear. I'm going to go after these people.
So to her, it became a moral imperative.
It's her life purpose now.
Sure.
You know, your kids are your purpose.
Sure.
If that gets taken from you, I guess that becomes the purpose. You know, that would become. I'm a single guy. I don't have any kids. Although many of my friends have kids of all ages. You know, even a 18 years old. But I do understand the commitment that's involved with that, and I can see how someone could, you know, put their life on the line after their kid died to find out the truth about their kids and do it for someone else. I mentioned when we did that, when we had the Cindy Sheehan vigil, that there was, you know, her mom having the stroke at that time was really kind of strange, and I don't know if there's any tie at all in any way, but there's the wife of one of these colonels who was a special operations in the Marine Corps, who handled all the dirty tricks for Delta Force and just all the dirty trick stuff that, you know, in politics are carried out by the military.
Sure.
Or special ops, office. Sure. Special operations, or some subordinate operation in maybe CIA or NSA or FBI, pardon me. Colonel George Griggs kept a diary. Now, in that diary, he names a very evil man, General Gary Sheehan. Now, I don't know if there's any tie there, but maybe some of us could start looking into that.
You know what? The bloggers... Well, I can hear the bloggers now furiously pounding on keyboards as you're saying that. So, I just want to, you know, say thank you again, and and we'll do this again real soon, okay?
All right. Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate it. Really.
Okay. And that was our interview this week with Steady from Ojai, California. Steady is one of those people that has been consistently supportive of our show and coming on and talking with us and giving us his perspective on current and and past and future foreign and domestic affairs. So thank you very much for joining us again, Steady. Look forward to the next time that we talk with you. The interview that we have coming up at this point is a gentleman who is one of those people that really gave me the motivation to do this show. And I'm not going to introduce any more of this next interview because I don't know that it needs any more introduction. But the next one that you are going to hear is Peter Werby. I'm on the line with Peter Werby, and Peter is a talk show host and host of Night Call, which is on WRIF out of Detroit, Michigan. And Peter is a longtime activist and is a fantastic guy based on everything that I've seen. Peter, welcome to All Things Reconsidered.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much, and thank you for airing my show. It's wonderful. It's kind of an idea how that we don't have to always depend on these huge networks or what have you. This decentralized, many decentralized networks really suits me very well. So congratulations on doing what you're doing, and thank you way in advance of our talk here.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, one of the things that that we've really been working hard is trying to, you know, over the last 5 years or so, is an independent media, because the dependent media certainly isn't getting the word out. So.
Well, interestingly, I just connected to what you just said. Last night we were just at a celebration for the 100th anniversary of the Industrial Workers of the World, the old Wobblies, the IWW, and we were reminded about the enormous amount of independent media they produce just through print, through newspapers and through pamphlets. And the newspapers of the Wobbly heydays at the beginning of the last century, 1905, till they were suppressed by the government in 1918 and 1919, like the Hearst presses, then they made our papers and our media seem fair, what do they say, fair and balanced by comparison. So they knew they had to get out their ideas in a manner that they controlled. And I always use as an example, for instance, up here in Michigan, in the northern part of Michigan, and in Minnesota and Wisconsin, where there were so many Finnish miners and lumberjacks, that they had a daily Finnish language radical union newspaper.
Wow.
So decentralization works, and people are moved to do it when they know that they can't count on the corporate media, which to me is never.
Yeah, I mean, when I said dependent media, you know, they're dependent on someone else for their news rather than trying to dig it up themselves.
Sure.
But you know, I wanted to sort of give my listeners a snapshot of your early history, and you know, and before I do that, though, I wanted to say thank you very, very much for everything that you're doing on the radio, because you are one of the primary reasons why I even started this program. And, you know, it means a lot to me to have you come on the show.
Well, that's great. And, you know, it's kind of hard when you're doing radio to realize, to really realize whether you're having an impact on people, because you're sitting in front of a microphone. And you get callers, to be sure, and there's emails. But I guess I've been gratified over the last few years to get email and to get messages from people saying that what I've said and the direction of the program and the kind of politics that come out of it have made them think. And that's the main thing I want. I mean, you've probably heard me say on the show, the last thing in the world I want is ditto heads. And if anybody is a Werby ditto head, they're an idiot. The only thing I want them to do is to think for themselves, if they agree with me, to kind of rethink what they believe and what they hear. If they don't agree with me, to use what I've just said or said on the air as something to challenge what they currently believe, because that's what we need. I mean, obviously, I mean, the people on the left, independent thinking, you go, yeah, independent thinking, isn't that what you're supposed to do? Well, yeah, but that's not a belief that's commonly held by everyone. There's a great number of people in this country that just are, you know, just when power speaks, they just nod,
yeah.
Assent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most important concepts to get beyond. You probably heard me say as well that you do an agenda. I mean, when I was, you know, a kid and before the 60s even, and
and a sense of fairness, a sense of decency, of honesty. And when you held that standard that I got from my mother and father up against the real world, well, the real world failed miserably. And so when people began to move against the worst and most overt abuses of official power, racism, war, poverty, it was pretty easy for me to just hook right up. And one of the things I read long ago, and I wish I could attribute this to someone, they said that it's not only an ethical imperative to be an activist, it's really the best way to live. And being involved, as I have over the decades, with peace and social justice issues, has brought me in contact for my life. I'm not, this is for me, and I would hope for other people, with such exciting people, such exciting ideas. And it doesn't mean you also can't, if you're so inclined to root for your local ball team or basketball team or football team or something like that, but having a life that's solely about watching television and rooting for some millionaires playing sports for working people, that seems to me to be a life really empty. I guess I feel that my life has been pretty full, and I'm not a special person. I don't say it's full because I'm particularly bright or I'm particularly ethically elevated beyond anyone else. It's a choice that any one of us can make, and there's so many things in my life, politically, culturally, that have just thrilled me beyond belief. And if I would have taken a mainstream route, I would have missed it all, to tell you the truth.
Well, based on some of the things that I've read, one of the biggest questions I had was how involved. You're right there in Detroit. Tell me about the labor movement there. I'm really interested in knowing how it stands today, but also, when you were involved early on in your activism, were you also involved in some of the labor struggles?
Well, I've been a member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists since 1970, so to that extent, I'm part of the labor movement. But by the time I became active in the early 60s, the labor movement, had really taken on its current bureaucratic form. And over the years we were involved in supporting some strikes, both through this newspaper that we founded back in the 60s and which I still work on today, called the Fifth State. How can I put it? They weren't real relevant to the struggles. The United Auto Workers, they were involved to their credit in the early civil rights movement, and when Dr. Martin Luther King had his big march down our main street in 1963 and gave the first version of his I Had a Dream speech, Walter Reuther, one of the founders of the UAW, was right there in the front line, linked arm in arm. And probably today that doesn't sound like much, but racist attitudes and the history of racism in Detroit was pretty powerful. Mostly what we were involved in terms of the labor movement was insurgent portions of the labor movement. Probably the most exciting was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was a black insurgent movement within the Detroit labor movement, mostly aimed at the UAW, which was, even though its attitudes were good on race, it was still mostly a white man affair. And so there were some pretty hairy episodes with confrontations, some of which almost became physical, between old line UAW bureaucracy and these radical, feisty, fiery, revolutionary black workers. And they had units at different auto plants around Detroit. The most famous was called Drum, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement.
Okay.
And so we white boys and girls came and helped them in any number of ways, and sort of being involved with that kind of activity that was really close to the bone. This was it was about power, it was about the people's economic futures, it was when someone said once something about the lollipop left, it was not the lollipop left, whatever the hell that was. It was serious stuff, and although we weren't the main focus of it, The decisions that we had to make about involvement and what it portended was had an extreme impact on me.
I'm sure it did. I mean, you know, so when you were coming up in Detroit in 67, 68?
Boy, I'm coming up way before that, but okay. Yeah, I was there. I was really, in a lot of ways, always one of the older people in my crowd. I'm 65 right now.
Okay.
So I'm a senior citizen.
How does that feel?
Well, unbelievable till my Social Security check comes every month.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, I never would have imagined you to be 65. I figured you were always probably in your late 40s, early 50s. But
that's what I always think. I mean, it's not a doctored photo of me on my website. Whatever, my family is long lived. My dad's going on 91, and
wow.
Suffered a little bit of an injury to his ankle, and just told me he was back swimming again. He wants to get up to his 50 length. So
we can look forward to another 60 or another 30 years of Night Call then.
If people are ready, I'm ready.
Okay, so what sort of, you know, do you remember much about the anti-war movement and some of the things that went on in Washington?
Well, yeah, sure. Sure.
Okay, because I know, you know, at one point you had alluded to that stuff on your show in light of what happened on September the 24th. And, you know, there's also another event coming up on November the 2nd called The World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime.
Right.
And, you know, just real briefly, if you could, you know, give some of our listeners an idea of what to expect from something like that.
Well, I've told people and tell people that have never been to events like this, going to something that has such mass proportions, and usually, I mean, if something's 10,000 or more, let alone the hundreds of thousands that often show up in these Washington protests, it's an exhilarating experience to be surrounded by that kind of energy, pardon me, with people that all are of a similar mind, and people that generally feel ignored and marginalized by the media, even though we frequently represent much, much, much more, and now the majority of people on a particular subject, like in this case the war in Iraq. And to that extent, ones in the 60s and ones in the 90s, and I unfortunately missed this last one because of family commitments, but yeah, I've been to ones recently, they have the same quality to it. The only thing different often in the 1960s, because of the whole edge of revolutionary fervor that was sweeping the world, there would usually be contingents that were determined to take, as they always said, to move the struggle forward, and would organize either into kind of little combat units to take on the police or trash stores. Or I remember one time we were at one, and the idea was to put a Viet Cong flag on the lawn of the South Vietnamese embassy. This was the U.S. client state, kind of comparable to the Iraqi government today.
Sure.
And this was in, let me see, it was in 1969. And about 50,000 people were in this breakaway demonstration, if you can imagine that. So there was like about 500,000. So 10% of these demonstrations in the 60s and early 70s were usually ready for a little more. But depends on how you read it. I mean, you could either say it was a more radical and hence more powerful or more valiant or whatever, or you could relegate it to being a sideshow, because the majority of demonstrations then, like now, were peaceful and legal. But even if you're out there with 10 other people, though, in Greensboro, I don't know what kind of demonstrations you get there, it is, you're defining yourself as well as how, trying to define reality. Because you can stay on the Internet all day and go, yes, Bush is a liar, yes, Bush is a war criminal, yes, Bush is in league to force the United States into a third world economy and all that. And if you go to bed thinking, yeah, I didn't get fooled, I didn't fall into the consensus, I rebel against all this, that's good, but that's like minor step number one. Then you have to put that into action. And I'm not saying that demonstrations are the only way, but the word for demonstration in French and Spanish and Italian is something like manifestation. You know, so it's a manifestation of collective protest against what's going on. And if protesting in the street ain't your thing, people should figure out some other way to do it, because you're not counted if this is all just in your mind. So those demonstrations are important, whether it's 5 people or 500,000.
Sure. Well, and I attended the one in D.C., and they're who knows how many hundreds of thousands. I lost count at 300, so.
Yeah, there was at least that.
Yeah. I'm on the line with Peter Werby, and we're having a conversation kind of about Peter. You're listening to All Things Reconsidered. We'll be right back. And this is Bruce Birch again. That was part one of the interview with Peter Werby. You are listening to All Things Reconsidered, and as you can tell, our audio quality is not always the best in the world, but it does what it does, and we're doing the best we can. We are presently doing, this is probably not the last thing in the world you wanted to hear, but we are presently doing a fall fundraising drive, and you can reach our website at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. And if you feel so inclined to drop us a few bucks, it would help us to, number one, set up a stream to bring this show to you live every week without having to hunt for the link to get there. And also, number two, to upgrade our equipment so that we can bring you a better quality show. Long live independent, not dependent media. And that's it for the public relations announcement. We're going to go right back to the second part of the interview that I had with Peter Werby right now. And we're back with Peter Werby. Peter is the host of WRIF's Night Call, and has also written a number of articles for the Detroit Metro Times, as well as another magazine called The Fifth State. Peter, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I want to urge people that are listening to check out The Fifth Estate. I don't know if I'm saying it. Sometimes those words run together, but it's fifth like the number and estate like real estate.
Okay, Fifth Estate. Okay.
Fifthestate.org, and we'll be glad to send you a newspaper for your inspection.
Sure.
And we just had our 40th anniversary edition come out, and there's even a history of the paper in the Times by me. So this is kind of an advertisement for myself.
Cool. A history in the Times by the guy who helped found it.
Yeah.
That's rare.
That's how you get in the press. You just have your own. But that's pretty tough.
Well, and that's kind of, I guess, what I'm doing too. But
people don't, I don't think, there are a lot of newspapers being started in the manner that there were in the 1960s, but not that many, of course. There wasn't anything like the Internet. So people put out their own papers. And I think there was at least 500 regularly appearing so-called underground papers during that period, plus hundreds in the armed services themselves.
Wow, even in the armed services.
Yeah, there was like battleships on the USS Ranger. There were 2 anti-war papers published on this carrier because they were factions. They didn't agree with one another.
That's too much, man.
The amount of anti-war sentiment within the armed services during that war is just one of the untold stories. I mean, people know that there was objections to it, but Richard Nixon famously said, "I'm not going to be the first president to preside over a losing war," which he was, of course. But so was the War of 1812, was actually lost. The British won that one, and they burned our capital.
Yeah.
But the Vietnam War, one of the main reasons that they lost is that they were afraid they were going to lose the army. I mean, mass mutinies were starting, assassinations of officers called fragging were going on. The demonstrations were relentless, sabotage, and every imaginable amount of social disruption was going on. And it's not, some people say, God, we were so bad. Well, this was an unresponsive administration, and we tried speaking truth to power, and we were absolutely ignored, so people had to go beyond that.
Right.
And the same thing's true today. I think the people in power everybody from the corporate elites to the Bushco crime gang, they kind of look and they say, well, okay. I mean, I'm sure they don't want to be down in the polls, but they'll cut off pensions and talk about reducing people's wages by two-thirds. This is like the 1890s, not the 1990s. This is like the 1890s. That's what they did back then. And they look and they say, well, what are they doing? Well, the representatives of the workers, the UAW, they're saying, okay, well, we'll work something out. So they go, well, cool. There's no, we're not have to pay any penalty. So,
yeah, you know,
I think of no other reason for self-interest. We all better get on the move.
I think I absolutely believe that. You know, and I you know, here in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is not, it's a fairly progressive city, but not, but you know, surrounded by a sea of red Republican counties. There's always been a fairly active peace movement going all the way, you know, all the way back to the mid '60s. But now, you know, we're seeing grandmothers come out in wheelchairs, you know,
yeah.
And we're seeing, you know, guys come up, you know, come out of the office building in downtown Greensboro, take their tie off and join the vigil. So it's really, you know, we're seeing, I guess what I'm seeing is that the normal everyday work 8 hours and go home and sit and watch, you know, corporate television is actually beginning to see that all these policies have created just you know, just a dearth of negativity, you know.
Well, it is, as I'm so fond of saying, Lincoln's dictum. You can fool all the people some of the time, and that was the majority of the American people at the beginning of, you know, following 9/11 and at the run-up to the Iraq War. But we're now to the end of the equation, which is that you can't fool all the people all the time. And the arrogance of these criminals and idiots running our lives is finally being exposed. And I suspect to Bruce, you and me, and most people listening, we can't figure out why it took so long. But hopefully it's a streak of decency that people think, geez, these people couldn't lie to us, could they? Or they couldn't really try to harm us economically for reasons of greed. But, yeah, and I don't think we need a streak of decency. Most of us have that. I think what we need is a streak of real cynicism, of absolute cynicism towards power, and realize, you know, the old expression, how do you know when they're lying? Their mouths are open, right? That they don't speak to tell truth, like most of us. I mean, think about how most of us in our daily lives try to be as truthful a person as possible and to say what is closest to reality as we can, and think how indignant we are when people in our lives don't fully tell us the truth. Well, these massive lies that wind up in the you know, the economic destruction of people's lives and whole communities, the destruction of countries, the deaths and maimings of tens of thousands of Iraqis and Americans, and the people that perpetrated all this are still sitting there, fat and sassy, maneuvering. Let me see. How can we get out of this now?
Exactly. Thumbing their nose.
Get rid of Cheney and put in Condi, and she'll be posed in. You know, it's an outrage. I mean, this French philosopher Jean Baudrillard said, "The only scandal is that there is no scandal."
Isn't that the truth? Wow. But I'm going to shift topics just a little bit. You know, at one point I had heard on your show, I think you said that you were, that you're an atheist. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. What sort of, I'm just kind of curious, and I don't know if you're interested in sharing about this topic or not, but why are you an atheist?
Same reason most people are Christian.
Okay.
Their parents were.
Okay. Okay.
it's that easy. And my grandparents were, so I'm a proud third generation atheist.
So are you also part of the American Humanist Society, or?
Yeah, how did you find that one out? I was when I was in college.
Okay, well, that was a guess, Peter.
Okay, because I was thinking, man, I haven't thought about them in a long time. Yeah, I look back at them now, and people that put atheism at the forefront of their political view, I'm always, well, okay. But, like, I love the people from Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Sure.
The people in Madison, and they do good stuff, and I love to read their newsletter, and I've had both their co-directors, Annie isn't that her name? And Dan Barker. But I don't spend a lot of time about that. I work with extremely devout Christians and Jews and Muslims in the peace and social justice movement all the time, and they are the best people in the world. They have their deeply held beliefs, none of which I have, don't make any sense to me at all, but it's the core of their beliefs, and it's what drives them ethically forward. And they never once have they ever said, here's a pamphlet, come to church.
Yeah, yeah.
They, I mean, because as they see their gods, or I guess do they have different ones? I don't know. That he would either lead a non-believer like me to the truth eventually, or he wouldn't be harsh on me because I couldn't intellectually or emotionally come to the same conclusions that they do. The fire and brimstone ones, the ones that have me burning in hell forever, those are the people that are dangerous.
And there, unfortunately, there are probably a higher concentration of them here where I am than probably where you are. You know, we giggle at them.
Yeah, well, they're dangerous. That religious ferocity has been responsible for millions of deaths. And I don't have this quote in front of me, but the reason that Madison and the rest of them wanted to keep religion, and remember, you know, the First Amendment, the very First Amendment doesn't say freedom of speech or freedom of the press or the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, which you would think would be the key, you know, would be the cornerstone of a democratic society, to guarantee that the government couldn't muzzle the press or you right. speaking or getting together to say, you know, you're a bunch of bums. Rather, they said that Congress shall not make an establishment of religion, because they saw what had happened in Europe. And for one thing, I mean, Europe was virtually a madhouse of religious insanity, along with, you know, everything else they had done to create this pathological culture that was imported to, you know, all around the world. But at least the founding fathers understood that the bloody history of the conjoining religion and the political state. So I always say, one nation under God, Iran, right?
Really?
So we want to, you know, the religious conservatives say, these liberals are trying to drive religion out of the public square. Yeah, exactly. Because they've got these nice little buildings where they can go and worship Yahweh or God or Muhammad or whoever the hell else they want. I don't care what they do in there. They probably think I do weird things. But once it starts entering the public square, you're asking for trouble. And if it always seems a little exotic, like, you know, you say, oh, well, that was the Middle Ages, or, you know, or that's Iran or Iraq today, all you got to do is look at Northern Ireland to see how awful the religion in the public square is.
Yeah, and absolutely. I was also going to say, you know, and look at what they've done with Harriet Myers, who has absolutely no qualifications, but she's okay because she's an evangelical Christian.
Yeah. I mean, that ought to be enough to disqualify her, those statements, under the terms of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
I mean, that talk about establishment of religion. It doesn't mean you have to state set up a church. It means that the political state gives its impromptu to some element of governance, and to put someone in there because they say she's a religious nut is... Doesn't bode well. I mean, look, you got a guy that's running us. Talk mm-hmm. about a religious nut who says that God speaks through him, that knows his first name. Well, I guess if there is a God, he is omniscient, right? He would know, but he would know, you know, all our first names. I mean, if he does, why doesn't he talk to me, Pete? Come on, man, you're missing a good bet here, right?
Exactly.
But he tells George, invade Iraq. That's scary. Mostly. People like that are institutionalized.
I was going to say that I think if he's hearing voices at this point, it's probably not God, but maybe paranoid schizophrenia.
There you go. Or just, I can't remember, what does DT stand for, you know?
Delirium tremens.
Alcoholism?
Yeah, delirium tremens.
The tremors.
Yeah, tremors.
For exactly what it stands for.
Tell me about IE America, and, you know, and more specifically, Peter, you know, I wanted to, you know, if you, more about the inception, but then what happened with your show there? And that's always been a big question mark in my head.
Okay, let me just give you the quick rundown. IE America was a radio network much like Air America, in fact, to some extent was a predecessor of it, although not directly. And it was owned by the United Auto Workers, who had the idea that they had to combat the monopoly of conservative talk radio.
Okay.
And so they set out to correct it. And it kind of bumbled along for a few years, and people I know in Detroit here, where the UAW is headquartered, had the idea that they wanted to get some dynamic talk personalities on rather than who they had, although they had Jim Hightower on, who was pretty good, ran a pretty good show. The only unfortunate thing was that, like everything else in these damn unions, they're so bureaucratic. And what they needed, it just was ill-run, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of doomed from the outset. Now, we began, I should say that my colleague at that time who began was Mike Malloy, one of the finest broadcasters in talk radio, and with the kind of edge that I think is necessary, and the kind of independence, political independence that's necessary as well. But so we began broadcasting in October of 2000. And it could be that they picked the wrong people, because we were so far over the edge at that time, calling Bush a liar. I mean, I would do, my shtick was counting from the, when Bush stole the election, counting from the day of, I can't remember whether it was, maybe from the, yeah, from the inauguration must have been, so that was January of 01. It was America held captive day one, America held captive day two. And it was just beginning to dawn on some of these small stations around the country that they might be able to take their little underperforming station and get essentially an underserved audience, half of America who didn't believe the guff and disinformation and outright lies coming from the Limbaughs, that they might have some liberal programming. Well, they would listen to Mike and me, and they would go, whoa, that's not exactly what we had in mind. Mike would do things like refer to Bush. He referred to him always as the Bush bastard. He finally agreed. Mike is uncompromising. He finally agreed not to call Bush the Bush bastard. But they would hear me calling it, a racket in Bush Co., and Mike calling it the Bush crime family. And they just didn't want any part of it. In fact, we began losing stations, and particularly after September 11th, we actually lost station after station. So eventually, we were down. We had a fairly large internet audience, but I think I was down to like four stations, and Mike was down to one. Well, it could be. I mean, the very fact that you stream my show, Bruce, and the fact that we're doing this interview suggests that you like my programming, and I suspect you like Mike Malloy's programming on Air America.
Mike is fantastic
as
yeah.
well. Mm-hmm. But as a if you're trying, I mean, you have to get stations to be your affiliates. You have to get ad revenue to make it financially viable. So what the UAW should have done was either said, we've got the wrong talent. Werby and Malloy ain't working. And I would argue that we could have done better if we would have had better management and tried other posts. Or they should have said, the management sucks here, and we've got to get somebody that can perform better and get more stations, and got new management. Instead, they didn't do either, and the thing just kind of bled money. Well, the UAW as a whole is bleeding money, and most of the investments they made in projects outside of the union itself, like these recreation centers for workers and this radio network, were just a financial loss of in the millions. So this new the new UAW president that came in June of 2003, why can't I think of his first name? Gettelfinger. Huh. Well, he's got a first name, and it'll come to me. But as much as people think of him as very conservative and what have you, at least financially, he said something's got to be done. And he first thing they did was to fire me. I think that the management of the network wanted to fire Malloy just because they didn't like him personally, whereas I always got along fine with my direct managers. But every day the Ron Gettelfinger is his name, so your listeners won't have to call him. The his office would call, and they would say, did Peter Werby just say that the Democratic Party was the other half of the ruling racket? And I'm like, yeah, of course I had. And they'd ask me to have Democratic Party office holders on. And normally they're so boring, and they're just kind of, their politics, well, are anywhere from marginally to somewhat better than the Republicans. But ultimately, I just hear a lot of blather from them, except for, I would always say, I will have on any urban black woman Democrat, because all and John Conyers from Detroit, all the rest, I could just imagine people switching the dial all over America when you get some of these Democratic representatives or senators on. I mean, I just think it's bad radio.
Right.
Anyway, where was it? So finally, they just said, Werby's not going for the UAW program, so he's out of there. So they essentially, so in a lot of ways, they fired me for political reasons.
Really? And they didn't last long after that anyway. Is that?
Oh, they lasted then. They fired me in July of 2003, and they closed up in February of 2004. And they had some, Christian progressive on, I just keep thinking of Marianne Faithful, but something like that. It was a decent woman, and didn't realize that she was scabbing on me. I mean, that was the other thing, too. I mean, that, I don't know. I'm kind of talking out of school. I should. I was just pretty disappointed. And not that the UA. I mean, I don't think it's bad. I mean, I certainly wouldn't like it. But if UAW said, hey, look, Pete, this ain't working. We can't have you on with four stations. Or, Mike, you've got one station. You're out of here. And then we said, we're going to try somebody else. I would have said, yeah, okay. But they did some things that were pretty shocking and pretty contradictory to what one would think unions should be all about.
You know, and I think sometimes I'm totally with you. You know, I've heard a lot of anti-establishment, leftist, anti-government control rhetoric out of people who are very much into government control, because that's their job.
There you go.
But, Peter, it's been wonderful having this conversation with you today. And I certainly hope that, you know, we can do this in the near future. You know, people are going to get a double dose of you on this night.
Well, that's great. I'd like to just take a little point of personal privilege and say that.
Absolutely.
I would invite people to go to my website.
Okay.
My last name is spelled Werbe, like in boy, Werbe. So if they go to peterwerbe.com, they'll figure this all out. A little bit more about me and what I've got going on a daily basis. And I mentioned way back in our conversation about the industrial workers of the world, and this is their centenary year, and to me it's a model of what a labor union should be. And that's just IWW.org. So thank you, Bruce, and thanks to everybody listening, and thanks for people that are going to stay tuned, and hopefully some of them will call like you do from time to time.
Yeah, okay. Well, and thank you so much, and you know what? Keep carrying the torch, man. We need guys just like you around.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. And you've been listening to All Things Reconsidered by Bruce Birch. My name is Bruce Birch. You can reach us online at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. Stay tuned for Peter Werbe's show, Night Call. Been on the air for 30 some odd years and is going to be on, according to him now, 30 more. Thanks, Peter, for joining us. Thanks, Steady from Ojai, California. Thank you, Ben, from WhiteRoseSociety.org, where our show is archived. Also, I would like to encourage you, if you like this show, to, you know, possibly, send us a donation, if possible, if you'd like to do that. If not, that's great, too. Keep listening. We love you. And this is the best of the interdependent media. All Things Reconsidered.
the internal machinations of the Bush gang, Bushco, trying to discredit a critic of the lies they put forth about weapons of mass destruction. In the process, probably emanating from Dick Cheney's office, they released the name publicly of a covert CIA agent. Well, that turns out to be against the law. But in the meantime, there was such cover-up and other shenanigans that a federal prosecutor, a special prosecutor, undoubtedly will bring indictments this week. And as David Gergen said, he is has been an advisor, I think, to four presidents, including President Reagan. He said the wheels are off the Bush administration. So we'll see how that comes down. Now, also, we're coming up to a grim number, 2,000 American dead in Iraq. I mean, we don't count the civilians that are killed there by the U.S. invasion, the illegal invasion that that Bush lied about. We'll talk more about that a little later. Also, class war continues, the war of the wealthy, led by Bushco against the middle class and the working class. And in response, we, the middle class and the working class, complain. All right? Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's email. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Now, James Moore, writing in the on the Huffington blog, Arianna Huffington, it's HuffingtonPost.com, if you want to take a look at it. Jim Moore says, what's coming up is the most important criminal case in American history. It's probably right up there, isn't it? This scandal of the Bush administration that undoubtedly will lead to indictments is way beyond any Watergate. It's way beyond any Monica Gate. This involves, just read a word or two. If Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald delivers indictments of a few functionaries of the Vice President's office or the White House, we're likely to have on our hands a constitutional crisis. The evidence of widespread wrongdoing and conspiracy is before every American with a cheap laptop and a cable television subscription, and we do not have the same powers of subpoena granted to Fitzgerald. We know, however, based on what we have read and seen and heard, that someone created fake documents related to Niger and Iraq. See, remember the big Bush lie? Remember Condi, the big liar, who's now, you commit errors at best and you lie at worst, and in Bushco, you get elevated. Why? Because you're loyal. It's like the mafia. That's why a colleague of mine, Mike Malloy, calls the Bush government the Bush crime family. I mean, among other reasons. And so she was the one that always was saying, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Scared the hell out of a lot of people. I mean, particularly people that didn't take the time, as most of us don't, because a lot of us don't even have the time, to really look deeply into things. And who would have thought that a president of the United States and his staff were putting forth